Good morning and good yawning, my Inklings, or, you know, whatever time of day it is for you. May it be a good one. Thank you for coming back for another episode of Catawampus Readings, the podcast where beginnings and introductions are studied and observed, however old they may be. This month we're looking at some of those classic tales I avoided as a youngster, some of them because I was told they were boring and depressing, and others because they intimidated me with their length. Today, we're taking a look at one of my favorite classics, although I didn't read it until I was in my 20s. And that's a real shame, because I think I would have had a blast with it as a kid. Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson is undoubtedly a classic, and one that's aware of its age. First published in 1882, this book is more than 100 years old, and is prefaced with a short poem entitled To the Hesitating Purchaser, which also serves as a sort of summary of the sort of tale this book contains. If sailor tales and sailor tunes, storm and adventure, heat and cold, if schooners, islands and maroons, and buccaneers and buried gold, and all the old romance retold exactly in that ancient way, can please as me they pleased of old, the wiser youngsters of today, so be it, and fall on, if not, if studious youth no longer crave his ancient appetites forgot Kingston or Ballantyne the Brave or Cooper of the Wood and Wave, so be it also, and may I and all my pirates share the grave where these and their creations lie. There's something utterly charming about an author directly telling his audience, if this isn't the sort of book you would like, here's fair warning and go find something else to read. You find this sort of warning at the beginning of each of the series of unfortunate events by Lemony Snicket and in other older works like this one. I like to imagine that this was what the foreword was originally intended for, not just to ramble about the process of writing or about the honor of translating the text, but as a short segment letting the reader know exactly what kind of book it is they're getting into. As with last week's book, To Kill a Mockingbird, the popularity of the book is working against us in seeking a decent summary, as every publisher seems set on exclaiming more over Mr. Stevenson's skill or over the age of the book than telling us anything about what actually happens in the story. So, I'm gonna give 5 out of 5 stars to the preface poem I read earlier, and I'll skip dredging a summary from the depths of the internet and instead give you one of my own invention. Treasure Island is a story about a teenage boy with a thirst for adventure, who's caught up in a daring attempt to gather the riches of a long-dead pirate. Jim Hawkins and the ship's crew must brave many trials, including the mutiny of the charismatic Long John Silver and his pirates on the very shores of Treasure Island. It's not the best summary, but it gives you an idea of what you're looking at. If I were to critique what I just wrote, I would say that it's more of a contract than a sample, more of a promise than any substance at all. It could be done better, but for our purposes, it at least lays out what we're looking at. This is a coming-of-age adventure book, and the target audience is probably in the same demographic as the main character, young teenage boys that like pirate stories. So, let's take a look at the introduction and see what this 138-year-old book has to teach us about the art of beginning a story. Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 1, The Old Buccaneer. Chapter 1, At the Admiral Benbow. Squire Trelawney, Dr. Livesey, and the rest of these gentlemen have asked me to write down the whole particulars about Treasure Island, from the beginning to the end, keeping nothing back but the bearings of the island, and that only because there is still treasure not yet lifted. I take my pen up in the year of grace 17-something, and go back to the time when my father kept the Admiral Benbow Inn, and the brown old seaman with the saber cut first took up his lodging under our roof. I remember him as if it were yesterday, as he came plodding to the inn door, his sea chest following behind him in a handbarrow. A tall, strong, heavy, nut-brown man, his tarry pigtail falling over the shoulders of his soiled blue coat, his hands ragged and scarred, with black, broken nails, and the saber cut across one cheek, a dirty, livid white. I remember him looking around the cove and whistling to himself as he did so, and then breaking out in the old sea song that he sang so often afterwards.
50 men on a dead man's chest, yo ho ho, and a bottle of rum.
In the high, old, tottering voice that seemed to have been tuned and broken at the capstan bars. Then he rapped on the door with a bit of stick like a handspike that he carried, and when my father appeared, called roughly for a glass of rum. This, when it was brought to him, he drank slowly, like a connoisseur, lingering on the taste and still looking about him at the cliffs and up at our signboard. "This is a handy cove," says he at length, "and a pleasant situated grog shop. Much company here, mate." My father told him no, very little company, and more was the pity. "Well then," said he, "this is the berth for me. Here you, matey," he cried to the man who trundled the barrow. "Bring up alongside and help up my chest. I'll just stay here a bit," he continued. "I'm a plain man. Rum and bacon and eggs is what I want. And that head up there to watch for ships off. What might you call me? You might call me Cap'n." "Oh, I see what you're at. There." He threw down 3 or 4 gold pieces on the threshold. "You can tell me when I work through that," he said, looking as fierce as a commander. And indeed, bad as his clothes were, and as coarsely as he spoke, he had none of the appearance of a man who sailed before the mast, but seemed like a mate or a skipper, accustomed to be obeyed or to strike. The man who came with the barrow told us the mail had set him down the morning before at the Royal George, that he had inquired what inns were along the coast, and hearing ours well spoken of, I suppose, and described as lonely, had chosen it from among others as his place of residence, and that was all we could learn of our guest. He was a very silent man by custom. All day he hung around the cove or upon the cliffs with a brass telescope. All evening he sat in the corner of the parlor next to the fire and drank rum and water very strong. Mostly he would not speak when spoken to, only look up sudden and fierce and blow through his nose like a foghorn, and we and the people who came about our house soon learned to let him be. Every day when he came back from his stroll, he would ask if any seafaring man had gone by along the road. At first we thought that it was want of company of his own kind that made him ask this question, but at last we began to see that he was desirous to avoid them. When a seaman put up at the Admiral Benbow, as now and again some did, making by the coast road for Bristol, he would look in at him through the curtained door before entering the parlor, and he was always sure to be as silent as a mouse when any such was present. For me, at least, there was no secret about the matter, for I was, in a way, a sharer in his alarms. He had taken me aside one day and promised me a silver fourpenny on the first of every month if I were only to keep my weather eye open for a seafaring man with one leg, and let him know the moment he appeared. Often enough, when the first of the month came around and I applied to him for my wage, he would only blow through his nose at me and stare me down. But before the week was out, he was sure to think better of it, bringing me my fourpenny piece, and repeating his orders to look out for the seafaring man with one leg. How that personage haunted my dreams, I need scarcely tell you. On stormy nights when the wind shook the four corners of the house and the surf roared along the cove and up the cliffs, I would see him in 1,000 forms and with 1,000 diabolical expressions. Now the leg would be cut off at the knee, now at the hip. Now he was a monstrous kind of creature who had never had but one leg, and that in the middle of his body. To see him leap and run and pursue me over hedge and ditch was the worst of nightmares. And altogether, I paid pretty dear for my monthly fourpenny piece, in the shape of these abominable fancies. So here we have an interesting mixture of techniques. Most obviously, we have a narrator who is part of the story, looking back on the events of the past and writing them down. Like we saw in other stories like John Carter or Gulliver's Travels, there's the promise that these things really did happen, implicit in the fact that the main character is claiming to set down a true record of events that happened to him personally. Next, we have the, well, I don't know if this would qualify as a technique or maybe a trope. Let's at least say it's very common. The main character fits into the demographic the book is most appealing to. This seems very consistent with stories that are designed more for entertainment than for education, if you know what I mean. Like, the main character of a romance novel is likely to be a woman between the ages of 16 and 36, and most of the audience is in that demographic or just outside of it. Similarly, the main character of the Harry Potter books is a school-aged child, the same as the audience to whom the author was appealing. I would venture a guess, though I have no surveys to back this up, that the Harry Potter popularity among older readers came about as the audience that delighted in those books as children grew up, rather than appealing immediately to an adult audience. At least, I know that the only reason my parents listened to the books as often as they did was because it kept me quiet in the back seat instead of talking their ears off as we drove down to see my grandparents in Arkansas. This double technique of appealing to the audience through the main character and claiming that the events of the book are real is part of what my creative writing professors would have called the hook. Readers who relate to the main character and want to have those sorts of adventures would absolutely be more invested in reading about them than those readers who can't relate to the main character or aren't interested in those adventures. Keep in mind that the introduction is meant to make the characters, setting, and plot known to the reader. I would say that this beginning hit on two of the three, and did so quite powerfully. We don't know much about the narrator at this point, either by name or by age, but we do know that this is the world of England in the 1700s, and we're introduced to a colorful character who's also at the heart of the plot, a tanned seaman who calls himself Captain, and warns the main character to look out for a seafaring man with one leg. There's some good interaction here, too, though we only ever hear dialogue from one character. He's the one we're supposed to be focusing on. There's been no mention of treasure yet, but this scarred sailor is obviously not a gentleman, and the title of the book is Treasure Island, so we can safely predict where this interaction is going to take us. It's really interesting how delicate the balance is between treating the reader as if they know nothing and trusting them to make connections outside the information given them in the book. I would give this introduction a 4 out of 5. It's done well in keeping my attention, but I would have liked to see a little more action on the part of the narrator, or perhaps some more description of the inn or the cove so I might see it clearly in my mind's eye. That's all I have for you this week. The random question of the day is, when you're excited about a new hobby, do you dive in without waiting, or do you do research first? Until next time, keep your hearts light, my inklings. Eat good food, drink lots of tea, and stay safe out there. This has been your host, Inkfire, and you have been a very dedicated audience. I'll see you on the other side. Thank you for listening to Catawampus Readings. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. If you're interested in supporting Catawampus Readings and would like early access to new episodes, you can sign up to donate monthly at patreon.com/inkfire. Special thanks to our patrons Corvus, Valkyrie, and Barry Marie.